Welcome to another episode of Out the Rabbit Hole here on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine, also on the web at KUCI.org. I'm Robert Larson. Got our usual opening music there. I got to write a little extra there. We had something from Mojo Nixon, My Free Will Just Ain't Willing. And this is our April 18th, 2008 edition of the show, 5:07 on the clock. Before we get started, a couple quick reminders. The opinions expressed on this program are not necessarily those of the KUCI staff or management or the UC Board of Regents. And if you want to give me some feedback on the show, I always appreciate that. You can email me at rglarson@kuci.org. You can also catch me on MySpace. That's myspace.com/outtherabbithole. The new movie Able Danger has caused quite a stir at the Rotterdam International Film Festival and is scheduled to be released soon in the U.S. This dark tale of intrigue deals with the crime of the century and what happens when a young independent publisher and coffeehouse proprietor is introduced to information that implicates some of the most powerful people on Earth. The real-life inspiration for this film is publisher, writer, and activist Sander Hicks in his book, The Big Wedding, 9/11, The Whistleblowers, and The Cover-Up. Sander is our special guest today. He came to national prominence as the person who published and promoted the controversial tell-all George W. Bush biography, Fortunate Son, after the mainstream publisher dumped the book and its author, James Hatfield, when the Bush clan went on a rampage against them. Sander is the founder of Soft Skull Press and currently runs Vox Pop, billed as New York City's only union shop, fair trade, coffee house bookstore. His Richard Benveniste interview, his Rudy Giuliani confrontation, and his Who Killed Dr. Graham all make excellent YouTube viewing. Sander Hicks, welcome to the show.
Hey, Robert. Good to be on the show. Thank you.
Yeah, I really want to get into this today. We love talking about this kind of thing here, and your perspective seems to be one that is quite needed in this field. So, yeah, it's great to have you.
Well, great. Yeah, there's been a lot of cutting-edge research I've done, especially into the death of Dr. David Graham.
Yeah, I definitely want to get into that. Let's talk about, since Able Danger is the kind of new thing now, the film is, has it been released in the U.S. yet?
No, it has not yet been released. There's going to be some sort of limited theatrical release pretty soon.
Okay, and have you been able to see it yet?
Yeah, the director sent me a DVD recently. It's good. It's a sort of a cinema noir. It's highly stylized. It's dense. It's intense. It's not exactly the film I would make, but I approve of it. I support it. It's a guy that lives in the neighborhood right outside the right near the coffee house Vox Pop in Brooklyn, and he was inspired by my book, The Big Wedding, to do a film that's loosely based on some of the information in The Big Wedding and also research I've done after The Big Wedding. For instance, I did innovative research into Mohammed Atta's CIA-linked drinking buddy, a German named Wolfgang Boringer, and that's the basis for some of the plot of Able Danger.
Yeah, the clip I saw, it looked really interesting, and I can't wait to see it, and I think it's one of those films that will just get people thinking, which is really important.
Yeah.
So, can you tell us a little about the saga with James Hatfield and Fortunate Son and how that led you to being a 9/11 questioner, a questioner of the official version of events that sort of seemed prepackaged and ready to go on that day? Yeah, tell us how that Hatfield saga kind of got you started.
Sure. Yeah, I stepped in and republished the controversial biography Fortunate Son after St. Martin's dropped it in 1999. This is the fall of 99. And it seemed really important to get the truth out about Bush and do everything we possibly could to not let the corporate media give him a pass. And so I stepped in and republished Jim Hatfield's book, Fortunate Son. Jim was a working-class Southern writer, an outsider to the New York media establishment. He had a lot of ambition. He had a nose for scandal. He really tried to put everything in his book, horns and halos, warts and all. And if you compare this at the time in the fall of 99, the other biographies of Bush were actually comparatively not as hard-hitting by a long shot. They were actually a lot more soft, you know, puff pieces, dare I say, propaganda for the ruling class. And so what I did was really tried to push, in the promotion, really try to push the fact that this is the book that had the SEC investigation, the Enron ties, the Arlington Stadium deal, the Bush-Saudi connections, James Bath, Salim bin Laden. That's right, that bin Laden. Mm-hmm. You know, this is a couple years before Fahrenheit 9/11. We were trying to do the Salim bin Laden Bush connection in a mainstream media way. But, you know, there was a lot of resistance. We were on 60 Minutes. We felt betrayed by our portrayal on 60 Minutes. We were on the front cover of the Washington Post style section. Again, like, the story tended to be about Jim, when really we were trying to say the story here is this Bush book and these suppressed truths about Bush. So when 9/11 happened, I was like, ah, this is the predictions almost of Fortunate Son coming true. Now, Jim had taken his own life a month and a half earlier in a motel room in Arkansas in a creepy spat of alcoholism and depression. So, and sure, there are plenty of questions about that. A lot of people have questions about that, but
you're pretty convinced it was a suicide, although it does seem that he was driven to it by these overwhelming forces.
Yeah, that's insightful, because I think that's the position I take too, is that the system kind of killed him. So,
yeah, very similar situation with Gary Webb, I believe. A lot of people want to think that he was murdered, but I feel like he was driven to suicide. But, you know, it's kind of sidetracking a little bit. But people tend to link those things together.
Yeah, and it's in some ways, you know, this is a larger metaphor for the way I do research, or you know, there is a tendency to, especially on the left, there's a tendency towards cheap conspiracy theory, in which people have a knee-jerk reaction that, you know, that every death is, you know, a CIA assassination.
Mm-hmm.
In some cases, you know, a suicide is just a suicide, and in the same way, my research into 9/11 does not indulge in every single pop culture conspiracy theory out there. You know, I had not focused too much on the different esoteric French-based theories on the Pentagon. You know, the missile theory around the Pentagon. There sure could be something there, but I think it's more provable that there was a pattern of federal protection given to the 9/11 hijackers.
Yeah, let's get into that. And so how you really delve into that in your book, The Big Wedding, is talking to these people, these whistleblowers, people that were connected with American intelligence in one way or another, and kind of shady, kind of underworld characters, but that's who intelligence often deals with. So tell us about these people. You know, I really commend you for all the footwork you've done, all the face-to-face interviews, and, you know, not just internet research like some people do. So tell us about, you know, these guys. Maybe start with Randy Glass.
Sure, I'd love to. Yeah, I feel that in the wake of Jim Hatfield's death, that you know, what I learned from the Fortunate Son experience is the value of humans. I'm sorry, I have my 2-year-old here too, so I have to, like, I'm juggling here a little bit, and I'm setting him up with a big jigsaw puzzle.
Okay, we'll bear with it. Yeah, we got.
Yeah.
We all have family things to deal with. Yeah.
Great. Thank you for being understanding. I know it's not that. I know this is not exactly the. What I learned on 60 Minutes, but anyway. But he's happy now. He's doing his big jigsaw puzzle as we try to delve into the jigsaw puzzle of 9/11. So what I learned from Fortunate Son and Jim Hatfield was the value of original research and human sources, human intelligence, and I was really trying to write the most credible 9/11 critique I possibly could, you see. And so I didn't want to do just internet research, although the internet is a powerful tool. I really wanted to get some original reporting down, and so I would travel out to Florida to meet Randy Glass, or travel up to Canada to meet Delmart Breland, and, you know, make transcripts of all of our interviews. And Randy Glass was very interesting. This is a guy that had credibility because he had worked for the Joint Terrorism Task Force, namely an operation called Operation Diamondback, which was infiltrating Pakistani arms dealers that were connected to Pakistani intelligence. And as early as 99, Pakistani intelligence people were telling him that the towers were going to come down. And so Randy Glass actually started writing these notes and faxing these letters to Senator Bob Graham over the course of the summer of 2001, and he had a level of foreknowledge about the attacks, mainly because he had called somebody up earlier at the State Department who had told him that, yes, we do know that planes are being planned to fly into the World Trade Center. We do know all this, and you have to shut up and don't go to the media, et cetera, et cetera. And that was a pretty amazing original discovery. The person at State Department we think Randy Glass was talking to was a guy by the name of Francis X. Taylor, an African-American top bureaucrat who was actually a right-hand man of Colin Powell's. So that's that alone is worth the cheap price of $14 to buy my book, Big Wedding.
Now, is Randy Glass the one that was talking to the guy and they were actually looking at the Twin Towers and the guy points to them and says they're coming down?
Yeah, that's right. And that was R.G. Abbas, who was a Pakistani ISI agent posing as an arms dealer. And, in Randy Glass's case, the media trail on him is very rich. NBC Dateline had done a piece about him. Other mainstream media had done articles about him. But none of them had ever actually went as far as I did. There is such a strong media culture in this country that just treats certain topics as taboo. And it's unfortunate because it really limits the amount of information that we, the American people, deserve to have.
Does the mainstream media give any explanation for why they don't follow up further on people like Randy Glass, or do they just not say anything about it?
It's a complex answer. It has to do with culture. It has to do with CIA infiltration of the media. I know that might sound a little out there for some people, but this is something that multiple credible sources, including a former CIA director, did admit that CIA has a major amount of influence inside of key places inside the mainstream media. So it's. I think the media there's almost like a gentleman's agreement that they understand that something is terribly wrong here. But at least during this administration, the mainstream media have been reluctant to follow their hunches, and it's pretty clear that they know what's up, but won't go there. And perhaps underneath a different administration, we could demand, I think the people need to demand a major congressional investigation along the lines of the House Select Committee on Assassinations that we had in 1978 that did investigate the strange federal-linked deaths of JFK and Martin Luther King.
Yeah, and when this information that Randy Glass was giving you, you actually spent a lot of time researching his background, making sure he was who he said he was, and doing as much of that as you could. And you did that with all of your whistleblowers in the book, and I really found that impressive. So many of these other 9/11 researchers just kind of take a rumor and connect dots that they don't really have the ability to connect, it's just speculation.
Yeah, that's true, too. Yeah, that's important because I'm a little bit more lefty than some of these guys and, had more of a historical background, a little bit more educated, not a lot more, but having like a little bit more of a historical education and having a little bit more skepticism of the federal government is something that you have to be a really good, bona fide 9/11 researcher. It's not enough to just have conspiracy theories. You really need a strong sense of history and a love for history and a love for freedom and democracy to really understand just how badly manipulated the American people are right now. And this is not the first time. This is not the first time that a major war, a foreign aggression, has been sparked off and justified by a media spectacle. And in fact, when I read Webster Cutpley's book, I got some great new historical precedents. I'm talking about synthetic terror made in USA, and he goes all the way back to the event the fabricated media spectacle that sparked off the Mexican-American War. We're going back all the way to like 1848 and James K. Polk,
yeah,
who was a corrupt Democrat who wanted to seize Southwest from Mexico and created an incident, you know, using a military provocation at the border. The Mexicans responded. And then, you know, there's this claim that the Mexicans had invaded Texas and had killed U.S. soldiers on U.S. soil. And it wasn't true, but it was it whipped the people into a frenzy of jingoism and support for war. But really, it was just the interest of American imperialism and American territory expansion. That's what was really going on there.
Right, and we also had the Gulf of Tonkin, you know, Vietnam, that sparked that.
Totally.
And that
was... Yeah, and even in the past 12 months, more and more information has come out that the Gulf of Tonkin was a part and parcel, a whole cloth media fabrication.
Well, and this event just months ago where we had this confrontation with Iranian boats, and there was this fake audio put over that video. So, this is just crazy, you know, trying to create some sort of event, with Iran. So,
yeah,
you know,
Strait
we know
Hormuz. Yeah, the Strait of Hormuz, I think, was an attempt to be another Gulf of Tonkin.
Yeah, so this kind of stuff goes on and on. This is Out the Rabbit Hole, KUCI in Irvine. Robert Larson speaking with Sander Hicks. We're talking about his book, The Big Wedding, 9/11, The Whistleblowers, and the Cover-Up. So, Sander, we talked about Randy Glass. Let's talk about another one of these whistleblowers you interviewed and did a lot of research on, Delmart Vreeland, a very fascinating character.
Right.
Tell us about that.
Yeah, okay, we can talk about him a little bit. I'd really like to prefer to spend a little bit more time on Dr. Graham, but real quick, Vreeland was also similar to Glass. He had a background on the street and also a background linked to intelligence work. This guy was linked to naval intelligence. He wrote a note from inside of a Canadian jail cell over the course of summer of 2001, just like Randy Glass, trying to warn the world about 9/11. He had some level of foreknowledge and he had details of the attacks. He had details that the World Trade Center and the Pentagon were targets, and including also Sears Tower and some other places that weren't eventually hit. But so I also, you know, got in the van and traveled up to Canada and crossed the border and went and talked to him over the course of like I think it was like 2003 and. And the more I got to know him, the less I liked him. But he was certainly very entertaining, very interesting to hang out with. He, it's a pretty wild story. He has a pretty weird background and a gigantic criminal rap sheet, some of which is also fabricated, because some of his criminal rap sheet is contradictory. Like, he's accused of committing crimes simultaneously with other crimes, and he couldn't possibly have been in two cities at once. So some of that is, you know, you have to take some of that with a grain of salt. But Vreeland also clearly was psychologically damaged, possibly sexually abused from his youth, possibly a pedophile. It was really unclear exactly the extent of who Vreeland was and exactly how connected to naval intelligence he was, but he did have a background in the U.S. Navy. He did have an incredibly long file from the Navy, part of which was redacted. Some of it was like, as my research went on, it was like disappearing by the minute there. Like, you know, something, military files and records would be there 1 hour, and then suddenly they wouldn't be there, and I would call up the different recruiting stations to look up the Deers record, and it was really quite ephemeral how information could come and go with this guy.
Well, and that sort of makes it more seem more likely that he was involved with intelligence, because they do those kinds of things and they create sort of false criminal records to make a person look like they are someone that they really aren't, so that they can do certain types of undercover work, correct?
Yeah, that's true. That's right. That's one of the points I make in my book, is that when you deal with former criminals as informants, it's easier to discredit them should they turn whistleblower. You know, I'm a little bit reluctant to spend too much time on Vreeland, though, is because his story is it's credible to me, but to a lot of other people, it's just so over the top and so crazy that it's almost like it doesn't fit within their preferred reality. Yeah, I guess that's the phrase I'm looking for.
Yeah, everyone.
Reality, and so it's almost like, you know, somebody who's concerned about credibility and mainstream acceptance. What little of it I have, I'm a little bit reluctant to always focus on Vreeland, although to other researchers like yourself, you know, he can seem like he's the most credible. Let me tell you where I've been at lately, Robert.
Yes, let's go into that. Dr. Graham, you've been on the speaking tour, and I know the YouTube video, and yeah, who killed Dr. Graham? Let's go into that.
Okay, great. Yeah, excellent. Yeah, you're right. I just did a two-week speaking tour of your fabulous, beautiful California and West Coast, and there is a lot of stuff on YouTube, especially there's an eight-part talk I gave in L.A. that my friend John put up on YouTube, and I'm really grateful to him. Because, you know, I'm really beyond speculation for this. I'm beyond the unanswered questions phase of my investigation. You know, I'm really into the answers and almost, you know, if I was an attorney, I'd be ready to indict. And I'm at the indictment stage.
Mm-hmm.
So, and the indictment would go up against the FBI, especially the FBI of Shreveport, especially people like Special Agent Steve Hayes, because I got now personal experiences with certain FBI personnel, and I can say, based on my own face-to-face confrontation with FBI agents Steve Hayes, that there's clearly a cover-up going on in Shreveport, Louisiana, around this guy, Dr. David Graham. Graham was a patriot, he was a Christian, he was a very mainstream conservative American, but he was an iconoclastic independent. He had a radio show, he had a dental practice, and he was entrepreneurial. He was trying to do his own natural toothpaste. He was very much anti-fluoride. You know, so I'm painting the picture here, giving you the background on the guy, very like strong, patriotic, independent American, you know, and so he happened to meet a couple of young Saudis 10 months before 9/11. He had suspicions. He had suspicions that they were plotting something against the local Air Force base. He called the FBI. The FBI threatened his life. This is where things get really hairy, and you can there's a pattern of criminality. There's a pattern of suppression of this guy's information. The FBI threatened his life. They told him not to publish the book he was writing about these experiences, because after 9/11, he realized that the young Saudis that he had been trying to warn the world about were Nawaf al-Hazmi and Khalid al-Midar. Now, if you know your 9/11 research, if you know your official story inside and out, you know that Khalid al-Midar and Nawaf al-Hazmi were the ringleaders of the attacks. You know, they weren't the primary pilot in the first flight that crashed in the World Trade Center. That was Muhammad Atta, but they were the other ringleaders. They were, these were the guys that the CIA was monitoring in Malaysia in 2000. These are the guys that were living with an FBI informant in San Diego. These are the guys that Princess Haifa was wiring all that money to, that the FBI supposedly investigated later. And it's an incredible story because, you know, this is the kind of research that it actually makes me scared in some ways, because, you know, the FBI in this country has a long history of suppressing dissent and dissidents and you know, you never know what they're capable of.
Mm-hmm.
When you look into something like this. And I'll tell you, I mean, the family of Dr. Graham are terrified, because Dr. Graham died. He was on the verge of publishing a book. The FBI told him not to. He published it anyway. He was about to print it when he was poisoned. Poisoned in Texas. The FBI shows up at the hospital and starts telling the doctors that this guy is crazy, this guy is suicidal, there's no point in trying to save the life of a suicidal man. And this worked. Some of the doctors left the patient's care because the FBI told him not to worry about this guy. And, I mean, that's beyond malpractice.
The FBI telling you to disregard your Hippocratic Oath?
Right. There you go. Yeah, exactly. It's like, you know, you shouldn't have a you shouldn't be able to make that choice. You know, you should be able to, like, be into saving it. You know, that we're supposed to be a hopeful, optimistic American people here, you know, not give up on people just because they supposedly were suicidal. But the FBI obviously made a strong case because the cardiac surgeon left the case. So there you have it.
Was any police investigation done?
Well, you're talking to the main investigator on this. I went down to Shreveport last fall. I brought along a reporter from Yes Weekly, North Carolina. He did a great 5,000-word article, by the way, you can get online. His name is Jordan Green. If you Google Jordan Green and Dr. Graham and my name, that'll come up for you on Yes Weekly.
Okay, and so the police never did a thing. You were the only one actually went down there and thought this was worthy of investigation.
Wow.
And so do you feel like the FBI, as they sometimes do, told local law enforcement, we've got this handled or something like that?
Yeah, it's pretty clear that they did. And, I did get some media on the local TV stations. Local TV has been pretty supportive of this. They know that something's up. But there's a big newspaper in Shreveport, and I talked to their main so-called investigative reporter, and she said she knew about the case. She was interested in it. She thought that there was something there, but just hadn't had time to get to it yet, but was planning on getting to it soon. And, that was like 7 months ago. You know, I feel so strongly about this, I even filed a complaint with the Department of Justice against the Shreveport FBI. It's so clear that they're guilty of cover-up here. I talk to people at the Office of the Inspector General at DOJ, Department of Justice, and, you know, I was promised a response within 6 months, and here it is month seven or month eight. You know, we're talking, this is like last October.
Mm-hmm.
Here it is mid-April. You know, I'm still waiting. I'm still waiting for some sort of response, you know. It's like, you know, am I crazy? No, I'm not crazy. I'm the one that's got the most credible way to, like, do a kind of indictment in the court of public opinion against a clearly criminal organization. You know, it's scary, but...
And how does Dr. Graham's family, what are their feelings toward the work you're doing right now?
Well, the family at first was not supportive. The family is admittedly terrified. They have actually said, if the FBI could do this to our uncle or our father or our brother, then they could do it to us. And to me, that smacks of 1930s Germany, you know, of like, well, if maybe the fascism will go away if we all just are quiet and nice about it. So that doesn't fly with me. I did talk to Davy Jr., David Graham's son, and he was extremely angry. He was telling me not to look into this anymore. This is a guy who used to work for Halliburton and Kellogg Brown and Root down in Houston, Texas. So this guy's got a history himself that's interesting.
Yeah.
Extremely bitter, a little bit confused, and but it was good to talk to him. I talked to him on the phone once for like about 45 minutes, and I think he eventually was sort of coming around and seeing things from my perspective. But he was just so against the anything akin to a 9/11 skepticism that was biasing him. But I did get him to admit that his dad's death was mysterious, and it did warrant a new investigation. But, you know, our system is extremely broken. Our political system is so corrupt and dominated by a consensus around money and torture and permanent war that it seems that even the basic, the courts, the prosecutors, law enforcement, you know, they're controlled. They're controlled by something and someone here. And in this case, these young Saudis were being managed by a Pakistani by the name of Muhammad Jamal Khan, who was actually a Saudi-born Pakistani. Very interesting guy. He admitted on tape, because Dr. Graham actually videotaped him clandestinely, he admitted on tape to having lots of powerful connections in Washington, to the Pakistani ambassador. He admitted earlier to Graham that his father knew Osama bin Laden. So this guy was clearly connected to what is called Al-Qaeda. And, when I went down to Shreveport, I walked into the FBI headquarters and demanded to speak to the bureau chief. And I didn't get there, but I did get this guy, Stephen Hayes, to come out, which was even better because Stephen Hayes had actually worked with Dr. Graham and had interviewed Dr. Graham, had taken all these FBI statements, you know. And it was a gift from God. You know, I'm a believer. I really believe in the truth and, a God that is full of mercy and revolutionary change. And I really feel that this was a gift from God, that God was protecting me from harm during this high-risk investigation, and that the fact that the FBI agent that I really wanted to talk to happened to come out and tried to blow me off. He tried to intimidate me. He was glaring at me. He was giving me the vibe of get the heck out of here. But instead, I just asked him questions, and I asked him about Muhammad Jamal Khan, and I said, was Muhammad Jamal Khan an informant? And he said, we don't discuss informants. But no. And then he said, like, 5 seconds later, but no. And I said, I'll take that as a yes. And he said, well, you can take that any way you want to take it. And then shortly thereafter, he actually told the receptionist to call security. He was so tired of talking to me, and he couldn't deal with me anymore. And he couldn't ask me to leave politely. He had to just bark out at the receptionist, call security. So that itself is a clear sign that we're onto something here with this Dr. Graham investigation, you know. And so let's review. I think the things that are clearly evidence, admissible evidence, in the court of public opinion, or any court, really. If you take me to state or federal court, I'll take this to court. The evidence of an FBI cover-up or FBI involvement in some manner in this guy's death was the multiple eyewitness reports that said that the FBI intimidated doctors at the emergency room. That multiple eyewitnesses told us that FBI did meet with Graham before 9/11. In fact, Special Agent Stephen Hayes admitted that he met with Graham before 9/11 to talk about these guys. Mm-hmm. And that itself contradicts other statements that the bureau chief at FBI in Shreveport made, saying that FBI never met with Graham before 9/11. So there's this official story that they're trying to float that Graham made it all up after 9/11. But then we got down there, we talked to Stephen Hayes, and he messed up by saying that, yes, he had met with Graham before 9/11. So that by their own testimony, the FBI is caught in a lie. And I'm angry that I can't get any more respect. I can't even get the local paper to, like, look into my research. I can't even get, I don't know what I'm expecting, but...
Well, you're working on it. You're trying. You're searching for the truth, and there's a lot to be said for that. And, yeah, I appreciate you doing that. This is Robert Larson, Out the Rabbit Hole, KUCI in Irvine, speaking with Sander Hicks. We're talking about his book, The Big Wedding, 9/11, The Whistleblowers and the Cover-Up, and we're talking about his more recent work in that vein of this Dr. Graham character and who killed him and why he was killed and what that's all about. And this is some fascinating stuff, Sander. Before we continue, do you have any information you want to give out as far as a web address or contact information?
Sure. I've collected a lot of key links and documents to the Dr. Graham investigation. And that is at sanderhicks.com. That's sanderhicks.com. And I have a blog on the GNN website that's worth checking out. And the transcript of my confrontational interview with the FBI in Shreveport is online. And just go to sanderhicks.com and you'll get all the links you need.
Okay, and if you're in Brooklyn and you want to have a cool place to hang out, it's the Vox Pop Coffee House Bookstore.
That's right. In fact, we just opened up our Manhattan location, so we're rapidly expanding, and we're going to take on that corporate mediocrity of Starbucks and really show the world how coffee houses should be community empowerment centers.
Yeah, I like that. If you're thinking of expanding, we could use one of those here in Orange County, California.
Yeah, I love Orange County. I love that whole area. Yeah, it's like, what do you got? Like Long Beach is there, right?
That's kind of adjacent to us. It's sort of borderline L.A., Orange County. But, yeah, we got actually a lot of people here working in Orange County. It's got a bad rap. I mean, you see the stuff on TV. You know, there is that element, that real superficial Orange County. But there's a lot of us here working on real stuff and trying to get the truth out. And so, yeah, we appreciate that sort of thing. So did you have anything else you wanted to say about Dr. Graham, or do you want to move on to something else here?
Well, I did want to say that, like, part of the lesson of Dr. Graham here, and lesson of Shreveport, and is just as an activist, looks like we got a problem here with the child. Anyway, one of the most important things I learned as an activist in Shreveport was to give up my stereotyped assumptions about what evangelical Christians are, or how they think, or how they act. Because, you know, as a progressive, whatever you want to call it, you know, pacifist, progressive, lefty, you know, even though I'm a Catholic and a practicing Catholic, I still thought, like, mega church people were all stupid and, Bush voters are all, unthinking people. But down in Shreveport, I organized and was in the community around the Shreveport Community Church, which is where Graham went, and I just realized how terrified this community was, and how real social change is going to come when the progressives and the pacifists are able to unite with the active Christians, and we're able to come together around, you know, revolutionary, nonviolent change, because that's what the message of Jesus Christ is really all about. If you know the Gospels, it's not about a message about intolerance and hatred. And I think the world is ready for that. I think the discrediting, the nature of the end of the Bush administration just sort of discredits the warmongering Christianity. And that's what I was seeing down in Shreveport, that these, a lot of the evangelicals who had voted for Bush were regretting it now. So for what it's worth, it really gave me hope for a kind of a hybrid politics between right and left.
Well, I think you make a great point. And actually, although there's a lot of weirdness in the whole 9/11 truth movement, it is a place where you see people from the far left and the far right and all other kinds of perspectives actually come together. I know they fight a lot, but you know what I'm saying? You've seen it. And
yeah.
You see, like, the Ron Paul types and the Dennis Kucinich types actually come together and say, wait a minute, we've got a common goal here. We've got this hidden sort of monster trying to bring a police state down on us. And Naomi Wolf's commented on this about bringing these, you know, different groups together, and that we need these evangelical Christians. And we may think they're kind of strange. They may think we're kind of strange, but we got to realize we got a common goal to try to save this country and save the Constitution, save the Republic.
Absolutely, absolutely. Yeah, so I wanted to mention that before we parted ways, and I'm glad we were able to talk about that. And
I'm glad, too. So I do want to try to touch on this a little bit, because this is something you make a strong case for in your book, and it's the way that there are not clear lines between the CIA, the ISI, Al-Qaeda, the Taliban, and the BCCI, and how that's, there's a sort of blurring of all of that, in which ties in with 9/11, because you see that how certain groups' behavior cannot really go unnoticed by the CIA because of this, you know, ongoing relationship. If you could talk a little about that, maybe specifically about the money that was wired to Muhammad Atta from ISI-related people.
Sure, sure. Well, one thing that Obama is right about is that we shouldn't be focusing on Iran so much. We should be re-examining our relationship with Pakistan. And I don't think he's right about expanding the war in Afghanistan, but I do think that it's interesting that he's talking about the 800-pound gorilla in the room, which is our historical relationship with Pakistan, because it goes back to the Afghan-Soviet Civil War. Pakistan was our cutout, our staging ground, our substitute. Instead of fighting an overt war against the Soviets, we used substitutes like the Mujahideen, and we were funding them not by giving them money directly, but by funneling a lot of money through Pakistan's ISI. ISI is the super secretive, powerful intelligence force inside Pakistan. Now, it's an unspoken truth that the ISI has plenty of far-right Islamic elements inside of it and plenty of al-Qaeda sympathizers. So that we saw Obama mention once, and then he was widely criticized for a couple of months ago, is that the Pakistani ISI is funding al-Qaeda, and they did fund the 9/11 hijackers. They did wire money to the 9/11 hijackers right before 9/11, and yet we give Pakistan so much foreign aid. They're the third largest recipient of our foreign aid, and despite the fact that okay, I didn't have the drain right on the bathtub. Sorry about that. The 2-year-old was like, "The water's going down the drain." Okay, great. So despite the fact that...
The ISI, the money to Muhammad Atta, that's documented, that money wired.
It is. Not in the U.S. media, but in foreign media. French news agencies and the mainstream newspapers of India documented that the head of ISI at the time did wire $100,000 or more to Muhammad Atta on the 10th of September 2001. Condoleezza Rice was even confronted and asked about this by a reporter from India at a White House press conference, and the White House published the transcript of that press conference and deleted the reference to the ISI director. So again, that's clear evidence of cover-up. It's clear evidence of sensitivity about we'd really rather not talk about this because it's just too sensitive for our foreign policy. Because if you read the 9/11 Commission report, they talk about how great it was right after 9/11. You know, we instantly flew to Pakistan and we made a deal with them that they would help us fight the war on terror in exchange for a gigantic $15 billion aid package. So now this relationship historically goes back to the Afghan-Soviet Civil War. We created we turned a third world empowerment bank, the Bank of Credit and Commerce International, into a CIA instrument. And so that's another key thing that people need to learn more about by reading books about it or reading stuff online. But BCCI, the Bank of Credit and Commerce International, was very close to Reagan's head of CIA, William Casey, and other major American foreign policy figures. So,
so much there. I mean, and this is a lot. People really do need to kind of read up. I suggest they really, you know, a good place to start is your book, The Big Wedding, 9/11, The Whistleblowers and Cover-Up, because there's so much here. And I really, what I want to stress about your book is that you don't get into, like, all of the 9/11 conspiracy theories. You kind of maybe talk a little bit about some of these things. You don't even get into so much of the debate about were explosives in the towers or not, but you know really about these characters. And we have this, like you said, it's very documented, the money being wired to Muhammad Atta and the connections with ISI, connections with all kinds of people that our intelligence is working with. How could they have not known about this? And so this is something that I feel like I get the impression from your book that you're like, this is really solid. Let's go with this. The other stuff, fine. We can investigate that, but this is really solid.
Right. It's like people choose your battles. We all have limited time, limited resources, and the clock is ticking here. We've got to take our country back. We've got to have an investigation. You know, we've got to have Bush and Cheney stand trial and say what they know under threat of perjury. So they have to be sworn in. There has to be a serious congressional investigation. There has to be an appointment of a special prosecutor around this stuff. I also think that the Democrats are not going to be people who provide this. It has to come from the people. It has to be a progressives and libertarians and Ron Paul people and with Green Party people and that's how we're going to get an investigation like this.
I think you're right, and I think we've been trying this already somewhat. We send our letters off to our representatives, and we do protests and things. But I don't know. Maybe an Obama presidency would not be as much of an impediment to this. I don't know. You know, it's got to start with people power. You're totally right about that. But I kind of don't see McCain or Hillary Clinton getting involved in this because they seem to be too tied to it.
Right. The thing to remember about Clinton is that Bill Clinton promised to investigate a lot of the crimes of the first Bush administration, including Iraqgate, other Iran-Contra scandals, etc. And he never did. You know, he once he got into power, he reneged his promises to investigate Iraqgate and other Bush-era scandals. So that's the kind of thing that people have to expect from any Clinton presidency. I think the likelihood is extremely low that she'll get the nomination, and I hope to God that she doesn't get any kind of vice presidential nomination either. But it's because if she would influence the Obama presidency to engage in cover-up. Hillary herself has got so much baggage and secrets and a mountain of dirt on her that she herself would never open up an investigation into something so sensitive and necessary as this stuff, because you would have to, she would be basically indicting herself for her own role in Iran-Contra. Did you know that she testified in the Iran-Contra hearings? A little known fact about Hillary is that she testified because she was the representative of Rose Law Firm, and Rose Law Firm had some clients at the MENA airstrip in MENA, Arkansas, that was involved in Iran-Contra and involved in the illicit cocaine trade that was a necessary part of the Iran-Contra commodities flow. And I published a story called Hillary's Secrets and tried to help take her down a notch, and I think it had something of an effect. I am famous on the internet.
Well, yes, and I urge everyone to check out all of your numerous YouTube videos. They're quite informative and entertaining, and you know, you have a great energy, and you seem to have a somewhat of a fearlessness, and it's real refreshing to see your style. I really loved the way you got in the face of Richard Benveniste, the 9/11 commissioner, and
that's somebody edited that piece. I have no idea who, but that was a good edit because they just took the good stuff, and so you can see that on YouTube too. And it's a couple of years ago. I actually look a lot younger in that piece than I do now. But I'm appreciative of the anonymous web editor out there who put that piece out there. But yeah, confrontation is something it's a skill I'm honing. I've also confronted Elliot Spitzer, confronted Rudy Giuliani, and some other people too.
Yeah, okay, and also you mentioned in your book, we don't have time to get into it now, but the Franklin cover-up, that book, and the documentary Conspiracy of Silence, and this is really weird, way out there stuff, but again, documented and has ties to all of this. And so I think what you do is you're connecting dots, that there really is evidence there to connect, which, like I said, a lot of people do that without the evidence to really be able to do that. So it's a real service there. And you also, have you gotten into the anthrax attacks at all? I'm always
I've done original research on that. In fact, that's another one that people have confronted. I called up Jerry Hauer. Jerry Hauer was indicted by the Citizens Commission to investigate 9/11. Jerry Hauer was a bioterrorism expert. He had ties to the Giuliani administration. He was doing a drill at World Trade Center 9/11. He has ties to Stephen Hatfield, who was the FBI's main suspect in the anthrax attacks. If you Google that and look at my newspaper, New York Megaphone, you'll see that we published a podcast, a very interesting phone conversation with me and Jerry Hauer. But the anthrax attacks are, again, a clear provable trail of evidence that links the federal government and the U.S. military intelligence apparatus to the 9/11 attacks, indubitably. You know.
Yeah, it's astonishing to me because the evidence doesn't point anywhere else but to an inside job as far as the anthrax attacks are concerned.
Again, FBI cover up. FBI destroyed the categorization system at Ames, Iowa, right before the attacks. That it was a categorization system that would have allowed us to track exactly what kind of anthrax this was and where it came from. And so that itself, it's kind of like you don't need to know all the facts of something to know that there's a cover-up, you know? Like when law enforcement and when the people who should investigate are actually obscuring the trail rather than providing answers, then that itself is indicative of something that's not right.
Yeah, well, we'll have to keep up the good fight on this. And Sander Hicks, thanks so much for spending the time with us today. And you want to give out your web address again?
Sure. My web address is Sander, S-A-N-D-E-R, Hicks, H-I-C-K-S, .com. And if you're ever in New York, come out to see Vox Pop. We're in Manhattan and Brooklyn now, and that's you can find us on the web. Just put Vox Pop into your browser URL window, and it'll come right up.
Okay, and again, your book is The Big Wedding, 9/11, the whistleblowers, and the cover-up, and everybody be watching for the movie Able Danger that'll be coming out that's based on that work. Sander Hicks, thanks again for being with us today.
Thank you, Robert. I really enjoyed it.
Okay, bye now.
Bye.
All right, yes, yeah, Sander Hicks, and yeah, do check out that book, The Big Wedding, 9/11, the whistleblowers, and the cover-up, and Able Danger. That I'm really looking forward to seeing that. It'll be, I'm not sure what style of release it'll be, but you'll be able to at least get it on DVD. And so that'll be worth checking out. And there's lots of links on Sander's webpage, so go to all those. And Who Killed Dr. Graham? There's just a lot here, and I know we put a lot. I mean, it might have seemed a little bit overwhelming today, but just take the time when you have it, go over this stuff, and just try to, you know, work how you can with it, and you make your own conclusions about what's going on. But I think it's pretty obvious that the story, the cover story we got from our government, it doesn't really hold up. So, all right, that's it for today. Robert Larson, Out the Rabbit Hole, KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine, also on the web at KUCI.org. The opinions expressed on this program are not necessarily those of the KUCI staff or management or the UC Board of Regents. And if you want to give me some feedback, it's rglarson@kuci.org. You can also catch me on MySpace. That's myspace.com/@therabbithole.